Breaking headlines, top Iranian security sources rule out the country's step-for-step return to the 2015 nuclear deal. The streets of Myanmar once again become the scene of protests against a recent coup despite a heavy-handed crackdown by the ruling military. And also in our headlines, nearly 40 migrants die when their boats sink off Tunisia as they try to cross the Mediterranean to the Italian island of Lampedusa. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, a top Iranian security official has ruled out any step-for-step return to the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. The official said Iran will fully resume its JCPOA obligations only after the U.S. removes its sanctions. He said the new U.S. administration has failed to lift the sanctions and added Tehran will further reduce its commitments if Washington retains them. The Iranian official also dismissed any official or unofficial talks with the U.S. before the sanctions are lifted. He said Iran's defense and missile programs, as well as its regional presence, have nothing to do with the nuclear deal. Earlier on Wednesday, President Hassan Rouhani urged the U.S. to end its inaction regarding the accord.
We hope those who have violated the rules and now say they want to adhere to them show this by their actions and end the economic terrorism against Iran and stop their violations.
Rouhani said the time is ripe for the full implementation of the JCPOA if other signatories fulfill their commitments, too. He reiterated that Iran will fully live up to its obligations once other parties do so. However, he said Iran's measures will be proportional. The U.S. walked out of the nuclear deal in 2018 and reinstated tough sanctions on Iran under former President Donald Trump. The new U.S. administration has signaled its readiness to re-enter the agreement, but wants Iran first to return to full compliance. Commentator John Stepling says, Iran's stance on the U.S. indecisiveness regarding the nuclear deal is justified.
I think Iran is probably justified in taking a pretty hard-line stance here. There's no indication so far in Biden's administration that his foreign policy will deviate from the previous six presidents or seven presidents. I don't think that Biden's administration is opposed to, you know, returning to the JCPOA, and frankly, for the U.S. And the Biden team, this is not a front burner issue. I just don't think they're going to take decisive action right now.
New anti-coup protests have been held in Myanmar despite a military crackdown that the UN says has left at least 50 people dead. Security forces fired tear gas to disperse protesters. In some locations, no casualties have been reported. Anti-coup protests have been ongoing in Myanmar since the army seized power early last month. The protesters want civilian rule. They also want the release of their detained civilian officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The junta has unleashed a crackdown. In response, on Wednesday, it raided the home of a pro-democracy member and detained him in a northern town. In the largest city, Yangon police swooped on a railway station to arrest workers on strike against the coup. Tunisia says nearly 40 migrants have drowned off its southeastern coast after two boats heading for Europe capsized. The Tunisian Defense Ministry says more than a dozen women and children were among the dead. It says Tunisian Coast Guard has rescued over 160 migrants before temporarily suspending the operation due to bad weather. The ministry says the boats were trying to cross over the Mediterranean to an island in southern Italy. Tunisia's southeastern coastline has turned into a major departure point for those fleeing conflict and poverty in Africa and the Middle East. Tunisia says it has intercepted nearly 100 migrant boats since the start of the year. Saudi women's rights activist Mojane Al-Hathloul has appeared in court for a second time since her provisional release from prison last month.
So let's hope that the sentence has been changed or modified a little bit. We'll see how it goes. Thank you so much for your support.
Al-Hathloul was speaking with reporters outside a Riyadh court before entering for a session regarding her appeal. She was detained in May 2018 for campaigning for women's rights, including the one to drive in Saudi Arabia. Al-Hathloula was sentenced to nearly 6 years in prison under counterterrorism laws. She also received a 5-year travel ban, which remains in place. She was in prison until last month when a court suspended her sentence. Human rights experts had called charges against Al-Hathloula spurious. Riyadh has imprisoned a large number of activists, including females, over their criticism of the ruling system. South Korea says it has agreed to increase its funding for U.S. military troops stationed in the country by nearly 14%. Under a new deal, South Korea will pay more than $1 billion for hosting some 28,500 U.S. service members this year. That's the biggest annual rise in nearly two decades. South Korea's foreign ministry says the increase in the contribution reaffirms the need for a stable deployment of U.S. forces in the country. The rise is part of a 6-year pact that replaces an expired deal. Seoul has been paying Washington for its troop presence since early 1990s. The soldiers are meant to defend South Korea against possible threats from its nuclear-armed neighbor, North Korea. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Jennifer Chang, who's joining us from Seoul. Also, we have activist and political analyst Ryan Dawson joining us from Osaka. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Jennifer in Seoul. Talk to us more about the agreement to increase funding for U.S. military troops in the country. The number has been announced as 14%. What have been the reactions as well?
Well, of course, the South Korean public is not all that happy with this huge increase in defense cost sharing. Compared to 2019, the figure has jumped 13.9% for this year. And then on top of that, there will be increases from 2022 through 2025 that are linked to the South Korean military's own spending increases for its own military outside of any alliance activities with the U.S. military. So from the South Koreans' point of view, this is a huge financial burden, and it's bound to create some tension between the U.S. and South Korean militaries. Now, negotiations have been going on now for years. Under Trump, the two sides were not able to reach an agreement, but now that Biden has taken office, the South Koreans were eager to clinch a deal with the U.S., with the new incoming Trump administration before they got locked into further stalemates like they had with the Trump administration over defense cost sharing. Clearly, the U.S. has become more and more reluctant to pay for the defense of South Korea. The South Koreans are trying to become independent, in fact, and defend themselves against any external attacks, not just from countries in Asia, but from anywhere. They are not singling out North Korea in particular, but the U.S. is determined to continue the alliance and not let South Korea be self-sufficient when it comes to their military defense.
Ryan Dawson, what are your thoughts on this new deal, the 14% increase? That's, I guess, more than $1 billion for hosting the 28,000 plus U.S. service members. They're saying it's the biggest annual rise in nearly two decades. Why now?
Well, it's an increase across the board, not only for the U.S. troops stationed in South Korea, but on South Korea's own military-industrial complex, their own industry. South Korea has become the 10th largest arms exporter in the world. And a lot of these U.S. troops, that also benefits certain arms industries in South Korea. A lot of ammunition, guns, and service work, and entire towns built around these U.S. bases, the service and their economies depend on this. And there's soft power politics at play here. When you give the U.S. a deal and agree to pay more for the military, then the U.S. will, in turn, loosen up trade on other means. And they are the third largest trading partner with South Korea. So there's always a deal there to be made, but South Korea often blames its military increases on the U.S. as sort of a way to divert public anger and say, well, it's America, what are you going to do about it? We have to have them here. And they're so important in trade deals, we just don't have the leverage to negotiate more with the United States. But they have slowly been increasing their own arms export industry the entire time. And you have to understand, this is a country that used to be one of the poorest countries in the world as recently as the 60s. Now they're the 11th largest economy on earth and the 10th largest arms exporter.
Mr. Dawson, the South Korean Foreign Ministry said the increase in the contribution reaffirms the need for a stable deployment of U.S. forces in the country. What do you make of those comments?
Well, what they're aiming at, and the big money maker, are war games. And this is one of the largest contingencies where North Korea wanted the U.S. and South Korea to stop doing is joint war games, because they often involve mock invasions of North Korea. Each time where you've seen arms incidents or shooting missiles into the Sea of Japan has been in reaction to these jointly conducted war games activities. And it's housing more ships, docking more U.S. boats, aircrafts, etc., more airstrips. It costs a lot, but it also means larger war games for both sides. They all get to spend a lot of money. They get to increase their budgets. It involves a lot of industries, so there's a lot of pressure on both D.C. and in Seoul to increase these events, but it just makes all of their enemies more hostile. It makes North Korea dig in deeper. It makes them more reluctant to give up their nuclear program. And a lot of the military toys they're spending these things on, tanks and aircraft, really do nothing to block artillery, which is what's at stake, really, if there were ever an actual war with North Korea. And North Korea is tunneled in. Most of it's underground. These things would be useless in such an assault, but they built them because they cost a lot of money. And as far as the exports, they're mostly sending submarines to Indonesia. It's really unrelated to the defense of the country. It's just related to defense spending. And that's what's driving the U.S. and South Korea. It's pretty typical anywhere you look in the world.
Jennifer, one last question for you. Do you believe that, or is it generally believed across the board, that the presence of the United States in South Korea is one of the main, if not the main, impediment for inter-Korean dialogue and a peace on the Korean Peninsula?
Well, definitely. I think that that is the generally held view. The South Koreans obviously want to hold dialogue with North Korea, but they are afraid that the U.S. will pull out all American troops suddenly from South Korea, and they are not yet prepared to defend themselves, not just against North Korea, but any external actor. They do not see North Korea as a foe like the U.S. does here on the Korean Peninsula. To them, North Korea is their brethren, their brothers whom they are aiming to have peaceful reunification with, and there is no chance that the North would ever attack South Korea first. So the alliance for them with the U.S. is not to protect themselves against North Korea, but any country that might try to create problems for South Korea militarily. That could be any country, they say. And the U.S. is now trying to maintain this alliance, making the South Koreans pay exorbitant sums to maintain it, while the South Koreans are not so eager to do that. And if this trend continues, I do not think that the U.S.-South Korea alliance will hold up.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jennifer Chang, joining us from Seoul. Also, thanks to activist and political analyst Ryan Dawson, speaking to us from Osaka. Elsewhere, the Armenian government says the dismissal of Chief of General Staff Onik Gasparyan has come into force. The government said the dismissal is legally effective as the president had not signed the decree within the given time frame, It said the president has not gone to court under specific articles of the law either. Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan dismissed Gasparyan last month after the army demanded the premier's step down. President Armen Sarkisyan refused to give his final approval to the dismissal twice. He said the move was unconstitutional. The president's office now says he has appealed to the Constitutional Court to review the legality of the sacking. The premier has faced calls to resign over a November ceasefire deal with Azerbaijan. Catalonia's pro-independent civil society has protested a vote on the EU Parliament to strip three Catalan MEPs of their immunity from prosecution. The MEPs are wanted in Spain for organizing the 2017 illegal referendum on independence. Cosette Kedri reports from Catalonia.
The Parliament vote to strip Catalonia MEPs of their immunity came as no surprise to politicians in Barcelona and Madrid. The vote, cast Monday and held secret until Tuesday morning, was backed by 400 European lawmakers. 248 voted against it and 45 abstained. The decision was welcome news for Spain, which is seeking the extradition of the former president of Catalonia and his aides for sedition and misuse of public funds.
The decision sends out three messages. First, an MEP cannot use their status to avoid appearing before court for possible breaches of national law. Second, this is evidence of the solidity of the rule of law in Spain and the respect for the Spanish justice system. And third, the problems in Catalonia must be resolved within Spain, not in Europe.
Catalonia's pro-independence civil society groups believe the decision is a major setback for European democratic institutions.
They should think more about what they are doing by covering the interests of the Spanish state, because they are undermining the ability of the European Union to lecture others in the world on fundamental rights.
The European Parliament argues the prosecution of Puigdemont and aides predates their entry to the Eurochamber, an argument that hardly resonates among the separatists, who point to the increasing support for their case among EU lawmakers.
The number of MEPs that feel uncomfortable with the current course of events with the Spanish government has almost tripled. And this is huge and speaks tons, speaks thousands of, on one hand, how the Spanish government is handling the situation, on how the European Commission is not handling the situation.
The European vote revealed deep divisions within the coalition government in Madrid after junior partner Podemos decided to vote against lifting the immunity for Puigdemont, Comín and Ponsatí. Puigdemont's lieutenant in Catalonia Monday noted that the strategy of the separatists to take the conflict to the world stage is beginning to bear fruit.
The internationalization of the repression of Catalan elected officials by the Spanish state is more relevant than ever before in the heart of Europe. We will see what precedent this case sets in EU courts and parliament.
As Spain mulls issuing new arrest warrants for the three Catalan MEPs, their defense team have vowed to take the case to the European justice.
All eyes are now on the European Court of Justice, where the next legal battle will play out, much to the discomfort of EU member states, which seem increasingly embroiled in the Catalan case for independence. Cosette Kedri, Barcelona.
That's a wrap for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The qualities of the people of Azerbaijan that helped create the 29th of Behman event. When the people of Tabriz staged an uprising, in my opinion, this is an important point which should receive attention. They had already seen the 19th of Day event in Qom. Under such circumstances, the people entered the arena with a participation several times larger than what had occurred in Qom, and they introduced an innovative ceremony, the 40th day anniversary of the Qom incident. When other 40th day ceremonies were held, leading to those great popular movements, it all began in Tabriz. In other words, the people of Tabriz were the front runners for commemorating the martyrs before them. Well, it was their courage, piety, and zeal which brought them to the arena and created those great events. I believe that if it had not been for the valorous movement launched by the people of Tabriz on the 29th of Behman, the people of Qom's bloody movement might have been gradually consigned to oblivion, just like the 15th of Khordad of 1342, which was gradually being passed to oblivion. Of course, after the revolution, it was revived, but before the revolution, the people were gradually forgetting what had happened in Tehran, Qom, Varamin, and other cities on the 15th of Khordad of 1342.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need, my Lord. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
The 19th of Day event by the people of Qom might also have suffered the same fate if the people of Tabriz had not entered the arena. However, the people created the 29th of Behman Valor, thus reviving the Qom incident and giving a fresh impetus to the revolutionary movement. Well, these three qualities, courage, zeal, and piety, showed themselves both during and after the revolution. In the beginning of the revolution, when foreigners were after disintegrating the country, the people of Tabriz entered the area. During the Sacred Defense era too, the Ashura army was a courageous and innovative army, and Shahid Bakri is also an unforgettable personality who will never be forgotten.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praise.
To Allah.
U.S. airstrike against the positions of anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border last month has opened a debate on the presidential war powers, drawing criticism from several American lawmakers who argued that President Joe Biden must have consulted the Congress before authorizing the raids. But as Tulsi Gabbard, former U.S. Congresswoman from Hawaii, has pointed out, the bigger picture is being missed by many.
The regime change war the United States continues to wage in Syria, using al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, HTS terrorists as our proxy ground force, and who now occupy and control the city of Idlib.
Gabbard also drew a parallel between the crippling U.S. sanctions on Syria and the U.S.-Saudi sanctions on Yemen, saying the embargo is threatening the lives of millions of Syrians and preventing the war-torn country from reconstruction.
In terms of the attacks on Tulsi Gabbard, in my view, she's been attacked because she's anti-war, because she has been honest about U.S. foreign policy. She's been honest about the fact that the U.S. has been supporting groups like al-Qaeda and ISIS. She has called for the end of the U.S. forever wars in the Middle East. And that's the third rail of American politics. That's something that both parties agree on, that those wars should continue. And that's why she's attacked.
Since ordering the air raids on Syria, President Biden has also been criticized for keeping up America's interventionist policy in Syria and following in the footsteps of his hawkish predecessor, former President Donald Trump, who publicly bragged that the U.S. military was deployed in Syria to take the Arab country's oil.
And then they say he left troops in Syria. You know what I did? I left troops to take the oil. I took the oil. The only troops I have are taking the oil.
Biden's ordering the attack less than 2 months into his presidency has raised the question, is the U.S. West Asia policy ever going to change? The U.S. and its allies' support for terrorists in West Asia is no news, as many current and former American officials have acknowledged who has been behind a multitude of crises in the region. In a speech at the Institute of Politics at the Harvard University in 2014, then Vice President Joe Biden painted a clear picture of what had been happening in Syria behind the scenes.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, and I have a great relationship with Erdogan, which I just spent a lot of time with. The Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. What were they doing? They were so determined to take down Assad and essentially have a proxy Sunni-Shia war. What did they do? They poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the extremist elements of jihadis coming from other parts of the world.
Well, I think Biden ultimately would like regime change in Syria, though I think that he understands that that's probably a remote chance. I think that the U.S. will settle for the balkanization of Syria.
In addition, Donald Trump alleged in numerous instances during the 2016 presidential campaign that then-President Barack Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton founded the Daesh terror group.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. Okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
But not only none of those speeches resulted in any de-escalation in Syria, the U.S. exacerbated the situation further by pressing ahead with its anti-Damascus policies. One of the recent instances of which was Donald Trump signing into law the CSAR Act in 2020, which imposed a set of draconian economic sanctions on Syria. The conflict in Syria has left a trail of death and destruction in its wake. The West's sanctions and attacks conducted by Israel on the U.S. are hindering any attempts to rebuild the Arab nation.
The head of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Francis, arrived at Baghdad International Airport
on a historic visit to Iraq on Friday. Security was beefed up in Iraqi cities to welcome the Catholic leader on his first international trip since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. The 84-year-old Pope called his first ever visit to Iraq the Pilgrim of Peace, saying that he was duty-bound to visit the country amid COVID-19 and security concerns. However, Iraqi officials were well prepared to welcome the pontiff as they beefed up security and imposed a nationwide curfew prior to his visit. Upon arrival, the Pope was welcomed by the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi in Baghdad Airport. Then he met with Iraqi President Barham Saleh at the Presidential Palace. Pope Francis called for an end to acts of extremism and intolerance and said that Iraqis of all religions deserve to have the same rights.
Over the past several decades, Iraq has suffered the disastrous effects of wars, the scourge of terrorism, and sectarian conflicts often grounded in a fundamentalism incapable of accepting the peaceful coexistence of different ethnic and religious groups, different ideas and cultures. All this has brought in its wake death, destruction, and ruin.
Pope Francis entered the holy city of Najaf to hold a historic meeting with Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, on Saturday. That marked the first time that a pope has met with such a senior Shia cleric. During the meeting, Ayatollah Sistani affirmed his concern that Iraqi Christians should live like all other Iraqis in peace and security and with their full constitutional rights. He underlined the importance of concerted efforts to prepare the ground for coexistence between all people based on mutual respect. Ayatollah Sistani also said many regional countries, including Palestine, are suffering from injustice, war, and blockade. He said the religious leaders have to encourage the involved parties to conflicts, particularly the world powers, to prioritize rationality instead of confrontation. He noted that the leaders have to urge these parties to avoid expansionism and personal interests. That is why Pope Francis thanked Ayatollah Sistani for raising his voice in defense of the weakest and most persecuted during some of the most violent moments in Iraq's contemporary history. The Pope's visit to Ur was another highlight of his trip. The city is where the prophet Abraham, a key figure in the Christian faith, is believed to have been born. Later, the Pope addressed the faithful at the Our Lady of Salvation Church in Baghdad's commercial Qurrata district, where back in 2010, Daesh terrorists stormed the church and killed 44 worshippers, two priests, and several security force personnel in one of the deadliest attacks on Iraq's Christians.
So the Pope is a man of peace, and there is a great potentiality for peace, a great potentiality that his visit in cooperation with Ayatollah Sistani, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, might actually contribute to defeating extremism.
After the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center Twin Buildings in 2001, the U.S. declared a global war on terror. That gave Washington an excuse to enter the West Asia region, beginning with Afghanistan. 2 years later, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence. In 2014, the country was overrun by the Daesh terror group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion. Interestingly, during the 2016 presidential campaigns, former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Obama and Clinton are co-founders of the Daesh terrorist group. The terrorist group was vanquished in December 2017 after a three-year anti-terror military campaign with the crucial support of Iran. The top Iranian commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, were key in eliminating Daesh terrorists.
And we must not underrate those. But here again, we have a great, if you like, positive emotional image of the leader of Catholic Christianity, Pope Francis, and the leader or chief figure of Shia Islam in Iraq, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, coming together, expressing what they have in common and being, in a way, friends and affirming a message of which is common to both religions. So I would say that is a very strong emotionally and passionately.
The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, as well as wars and repression by Daesh terrorists, devastated Iraq's minority Christian community. The instability and persistent chaos resulted in a drop in the number of Christians from nearly 1.4 million to about 250,000 today. In a speech during his visit, the Pope called Iraq the cradle of civilization. He noted that the country has suffered the disastrous effects of the so-called war on terrorism. Isn't it high time for the West, especially the U.S., to stop its intervention in Iraq and put an end to its disastrous presence there?
The United States remains on a collision course with the International Criminal Court even after the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump yielded power to the Joe Biden administration, which was expected to be softer on issues related to international organizations. The reasons for the troubled relations have remained unchanged: the ICC's decision to probe war crimes committed by the United States and Israel. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who has been probing war crimes committed by Israel, the U.S., and their allies, said in December 2019 that such crimes have been or were committed in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She named the Israeli military, which has for years unleashed a reign of terror on Palestinians, as the perpetrator of war crimes. The ICC prosecutor further noted that there was a reasonable basis to launch a probe into Israeli military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. Bensouda then asked judges to rule on the extent of the court's jurisdiction in the case, and the court last month established that it had jurisdiction. The announcement was not received well by Washington and Tel Aviv. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call that the U.S. opposes any such probe as the court has no jurisdiction over the matter. The phone call followed U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's statement that Washington firmly opposes and is deeply disappointed by the decision.
If the state is very certain and very secure that the Israeli regime and these occupiers have not committed war crimes, so why not give a chance to the investigators, the bipartisan group that will be coming in, that is not biased? And they will be investigating all the cases that they have in their files, in their system, and to prove that they're innocent, right? And then at that point, we don't have this continuous problem coming up and arising again.
The U.S. and Israel have repeatedly shown their opposition to being held accountable for their actions over the years. The ICC, which has often sought to expose war crimes committed by the Israeli regime and the U.S. around the world, has faced bullying and intimidation from both Tel Aviv and Washington. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on the Hague-based tribunal staff last year, targeting them with asset freezes and travel bans, accusing them of violating the U.S. national sovereignty by launching a probe into war crimes committed by the U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The Biden administration took no immediate action to reverse the move, despite promising to put overruling Trump's damaging measures on top of his agenda. The new U.S. administration did announce it would rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council, which its predecessor withdrew from 2018, citing an anti-Israeli bias, but it said upon re-engaging with the U.N. body, it will press to eliminate a disproportionate focus on its Israeli ally.
I mean, this shows essentially from the beginning that they're not going there really for human rights. They're going there to secure and support Israel and to bury their war crimes and to get people away from holding the Israeli regime accountable. I mean, why is there all these resolutions in the first place against Israel? Obviously because there's continuous developments, there's continuous war crimes, there's continuous bombardments, there's continuous blockades, there's continuous crimes.
We will be back. And I'm a man of my word. America is back. I speak today as President of the United States at the very start of my administration, and I'm sending a clear message to the world. America is back.
Joe Biden has repeated this sentence multiple times since becoming president, taking a veiled sideswipe at his predecessor's isolation foreign policy and promising a return to multilateralism in a bid to win over the estranged U.S. allies and revive the frosty transatlantic relations. While Washington's European partners have largely expressed support for his administration, divisions between them still persist. In the latest example, an EU spokesperson said, "The bloc supports the ICC as an independent and impartial judicial institution with no political objectives to pursue." Peter Stano was responding to a request for comment on Netanyahu's recent diatribe against the court, who had blasted the war crime probe as, quote, "the essence of anti-Semitism." President Biden says he will bring back what he calls America's moral leadership in the world. The question is, how can the U.S. advocate such leadership while it continues to penalize those who work to expose crimes instead of the true culprits?
The recent coup in Myanmar has taken the time back to 1962, when the military took control of the Southeast Asian country 14 years after its independence from Britain. Since then, the stage was set for military's power play until 2011, when Myanmar underwent democratic reforms and began parliamentary elections. The military junta seized power on February 1 and declared a one-year-long state of emergency after detaining the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and members of her National League for Democracy party, among other elected government officials. The military claimed that the November election, in which Suu Kyi's party won with a landslide, was rigged. However, the Election Commission nullified this claim, stating that there was no evidence. While the ousted leader is under house arrest, military commander-in-chief Ming Aung Hlaing has taken power. Despite public opposition, he attempted to justify the takeover by saying the military is on the people's side and would form a true and disciplined democracy. That is while the military junta says it wants to hold a free and fair election once the state of emergency is over. However, the country has lapsed into chaos since February 1 coup, sparking daily mass protests as well as global condemnation. The U.S. and the European Union are weighing up imposing sanctions against the junta leaders. The U.S. already has imposed some sanctions against some of the major junta leaders. Nonetheless, the military has ignored the international outcry and responded to the public opposition with escalating force. So far, 50 people have been killed and hundreds arrested during the military junta's lethal crackdown on nationwide anti-coup protests. Wednesday marked Myanmar's bloodiest day since the military takeover. The UN Special Envoy on Myanmar confirmed that 38 people lost their lives after security forces opened fire on protesters demanding the return of civilian rule in the country.
Well, I guess nobody knows why, but my speculation is that they are the ones who hold on to the power at this moment, and they are very motivated by having the power, whether economically or running the country. So now, because they are taking over the country by force and nobody wants to have the military run the country, and therefore people are standing up for their rights, and that is exactly what the dictators, the Burmese government junta, doesn't want it.
Since the deadly military crackdown on the Rohingya Muslims in 2017, Aung San Suu Kyi's government has faced international condemnations. Following that, the West's interest in Myanmar has faded, and now with the military coup and the bloody crackdown on demonstrators, Myanmar is further alienating itself from the West. Moreover, as the Southeast Asian country is currently grappling with the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic and the military coup on its economy, the U.S. and the European Union are considering imposing sanctions. That could worsen the current crisis in Myanmar and push it into an ally's corner, namely China. The U.S. has already placed sanctions on Myanmar and has condemned the junta leader's harsh crackdown on the protesters. Moreover, the EU has also come out and condemned Myanmar's military, suspending development funds for the country. Yet what is interesting is how the Southeast Asian nations have so far rebuffed U.S. sanctions, which, in their words, has given the generals a lifeline.
The most important thing that we also need to understand is that Burma is one of the countries where China invests most. So, for example, we're talking about the projects that are linked to the China-Myanmar Economic Corridor, which is part of the Beijing Big Belt Road Initiative that loop together a series of strategic ports, railways, and pipelines across the globe.
No Asian country has come out supporting the sanctions and anti-Myanmar actions. In this instance, China can therefore benefit economically from Myanmar, as trade with the West is now restricted.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام وقيل له صف لنا العاقل وقال عليه السلام: هو الذي يضع الشيء مواضعه. فقيل: فصف لنا الجاهل. فقال: قد فعلت.
It was said to Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, "Describe the wise to us." And he said, "The wise is one who places things in their proper positions." Then he was asked, "Describe the ignorant to us." And he said, "I have already done so."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the profound lessons which we learn from the truly universal persona of Imam Ali is regarding this fact that the fountainhead and the source of theology in the Muslim world leads back to Imam Ali alayhi salam. So as far as theology, beyond a doubt, Imam Ali is the founder of this science on which he has greatly elaborated. The compilation of Imam Ali's sermons and short sayings and letters by the name of Nahjul Balagha, the Peak of Eloquence, truly testifies to this fact that Imam Ali alayhi salam was a pioneer and a front runner in Islamic theology. Both Muslim and non-Muslim scholars, Shia and Sunni scholars, have attested to this fact that Imam Ali alayhi salam, his words, his statements on a whole variety of sciences was so excellent and superb that it can be said these are the words of someone who is greater than a human being. And according to some scholars, Sunni scholars as well, the words and statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam are second only to the words of the Holy Quran. Now, talking about theology, beyond a doubt, as we said, he is the founder of this science. Imam Ali used to speak about theology in his sermons and delivered them to the people, who in turn greatly benefited from these teachings and clarifications upon Islamic theology. Furthermore, scholars also referred to Imam Ali for solving their scientific and theological problems. And those who tried to learn this science from Imam Ali alayhi salam were namely four groups: the Mu'tazila, the Ash'ariya, the Shia, and the Khawarij. The attribution of Imam Ali to Shiaism is obvious and requires no explanation. But it is very interesting that the Mu'tazila, the Ash'ariya, and the Khawarij all either directly or indirectly link their theological schools of thought back to Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. And so, as per the consensus of Muslim and non-Muslim scholars, Shia and Sunni scholars, Imam Ali alayhi salam is the fountainhead of theology, truly a profound statement, a profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
صل على محمد محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله
I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. Ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger. Protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. Ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
That when a person of Bani Israel comes and says to him, Ah, your Khilafah has been taken. The Prophet just died and they took your Khilafah. Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions, he says, Your forefathers, before their feet had dried of salt water, when Musa went up to the mountains, you idolized a cow and you worshipped it. We Muslims are united in Tawheed. Our Salah is intact. Our Quran